You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
There was a time to be really despondent about it. But the way I see it now is that we pick ourselves up and we fight back. That's what I think it's all about.
Elizabeth Warren asking the question of how the Democrats fight back. Is she herself part of the answer? And what might comprise the rest? Also ahead, is Turkey really attempting to spy on German classrooms? And if so, what on earth for? Later in the show, we'll look forward to tonight's live edition of The Menu here at Midori House and...
I want to step up to this challenge, and as an ally, I don't want to be a passive ally, I want to be an active ally, and so I took the play and I began adapting it.
Barry Jenkins up for an Oscar this Sunday as Moonlight stares down odds-on favourite La La Land. We'll assess the political undertones of this year's awards. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests for the first portion of today's show, at least, are Monocle 24's executive producer Tom Edwards and Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief Chris Lord. Welcome both. Now, President Donald Trump has been saying things again, this time to the Conservative Political Action Conference in Maryland. It was mostly the usual melange of belligerent non-sequiturs, focused principally on the virtues of himself and the vices of the media, though including on this occasion a shout-out to a friend of his called Jim, who is apparently now too terrified to visit Paris. Harden up, Jim. Democratic Party leaders are due to meet this weekend to ponder a strategy of opposition. But has that decision already been made for them? Chris, the Democratic leaders, and they do still need to choose a party chairman, but they apparently sense that their base, this sort of outraged liberal insurgency that we've seen across the United States in the last 5 weeks, will settle for nothing less than, as they say, total war. Is that actually the way forward?
I don't think it is, no. I mean, I think, first of all, I've heard this phrase, total war. We were talking about it just before the program started. This idea of total war from the opposition, what does that even actually mean when we start to put it into any kind of political practice? And I think as well, when you start to talk about harnessing the power of social media, which is essentially what we're talking about, that's where a lot of course, it comes down to protests as well, but a lot of the outrage that we're actually talking about, that they're talking about from this disgruntled liberal mass, they're talking about it through media, through press, through people being talked to, people expressing their views on Twitter and so on, and getting that. How do you start to... What you're essentially saying is you're trying to harness a very amorphous mass of outrage. And that is not a political position. So if you want to take a position, a proper oppositional position towards Donald Trump, then it can't be trying to mould yourself around outrage.
But hasn't Trump managed to get elected president largely off the back of an amorphous mass of outrage?
Precisely for that reason why I say it's the wrong way to go. Why on earth? We all agree that that is an incorrect process of politics. That's not politics anymore, you know?
What if it is?
Well, maybe in our time it is, you know? I mean, I'm coming to you from a perspective in many ways of Turkey. And if you look to Turkey, politics there are based on outrage. That's what that's many ways why President Erdogan is so popular.
Turkey we will get to shortly. But Tom, when they say total war, I don't imagine they're literally talking about laying siege to Fort Sumter. I suspect it's more likely a program of obdurate boneheaded obstruction of the sort, ironically enough, demonstrated by the Republican Party while Barack Obama was president. Is that an option, perhaps eventually? It's not an option now because they don't control either house and they only hold 17 governor's mansions, if I've done my sums right. But is that something they should aspire to, just to block, interrupt, intercept, annoy, interdict, etc., etc., at every possible turn?
I'd like to think that they set their sights slightly higher and maybe have some slightly loftier ambitions. I agree with Chris absolutely, actually, about this idea of not pandering to a lowest common denominator and not trying to harness outrage. I agree with you, Andrew, that that seems foolish because that is what Trump has done, is doing, and looks set fair to continue to do. And it's not about pursuing some kind of, you know, political idealism such as we see, I don't know, the Labour opposition, I use the term loosely, in this country doing under Corbyn, where they're keeping their extremely committed left-leaning support happy, but they're doing a pretty good job at rewriting the record books of poor electoral performance, managing to hand effectively the government a by-election win, the likes of which we haven't seen for essentially 50 odd years in this country. I think the Democrats need to be very careful. They need to balance an appeal to their base and a vocal opposition to Trump with some political expediency. My worry is that this will come down to, and we talked about this before Trump even won the election, a lack of credible personnel. And throughout Europe and in the United States, it's a problem for both sides. It was a problem for the Republicans, let's not forget. I mean, Trump isn't really even a Republican. He used to be a Democrat.
And part of the reason he ended up, of course, being the nominee was that he was up against a field of, you know, 15 of the most ridiculous people in America.
This is it. And so I think, you know, to say, can Elizabeth Warren take on the responsibility, or, you know, is there a role for someone like Biden to play? It's slightly demonstrating the point that there is a paucity of strong, dynamic personality, and people are willing to overlook other forms. If you look at, say, the wave that Trudeau rode in Canada, you know, he's part of the elite, a wealthy man, you know, scion of a political family, etc. But people saw in him the opportunity to invest some aspiration in a younger, more dynamic candidate. And I just don't see those people in the Democrat movement, certainly not within the movement who will be able to mount a coherent challenge within the next 4 years.
Isn't that something about that coherence? I mean, the Trudeau example, just to jump in, but the Trudeau example is very interesting, because when we start to talk about should they harness the anger of lots of people, actually what you're kind of talking about is driving people away from centrism, right? I mean, that's ultimately what that's about. And Trudeau has been able to talk to people across a spectrum. He's been able to talk to centrists and to people further left along the
path. Trudeau's lucky, though, and I guess there's the question about whether to what extent he's made his own luck, but he got elected in a country which does still seem to be adhering to the conventional wisdom that elections are, when all said and done, won in the centre. Can we still make that assumption?
Well, what interests me is, if you go back to the campaign, there was probably one poignant Democratic voice that made the argument several times, well, possibly not often enough, many would say, that if somebody is chasing, you know, is in a race to the bottom, you have to try and elevate the discussion. And Michelle Obama did that very ably. And it was, I mean, it's a damning indictment of the rest of the people in that field that those words resonate still now. That was the best performance. It was the most articulate defense of trying to stick to your principles rather than go for your gun. And I think, you know, if you've got the First Lady, who's the only person, you know, in the last 18 months who managed to articulate that, then you've got a problem. And that's why I think the Democrats can kick this around this weekend as much as they want, and they can, you know, find a new chair and restate their vision and their commitment to any kind of politics. But until they find a person behind whom their base can fall into lockstep, they've got a problem.
Just a final thought on this one, Chris. Is there something to be said for the idea of, and this is my own pet theory, it may not hold water, I haven't really thought it all the way through, of as far as possible just ignoring Trump in the hope or expectation that his administration will eventually self-destruct?
I mean, I think one thing that struck me this week, there was a great New York Times opinion piece this week, which was a writer, he spent a week not reading any Trump stories in the news feeds or in the papers.
That
and
would
so
be
and so
some
forth.
Holiday, wouldn't it?
But one thing he said, first of all, was that he almost, you know, he lost a lot of news. But then he also realised how much was going on in the world that he didn't know was happening. How many things, I mean, from whether it was down from Mosul right through to things happening in the South China Sea. And I think this maybe comes back to that. During that election campaign, one of the things that was fired at Hillary Clinton was you don't have policy. You have denial and outrage at what Donald Trump is saying, but you don't have your own platforms. You don't have things to say. You don't have directions for this country when we generally do feel that things maybe are not going in the direction that the US wants it to go in.
Andrew, one brief thing I'd say on this is there's a strange alliance that could be forged here between, if you like, mainstream Republicans and Democrats, who may find, after a few more months of rank incompetence from Trump and his White House team, that their interests align, by which I mean they may both prefer to get rid of Trump. And interestingly, I think the most damage to Trump could be done from the Republican side rather than the Democrat side.
Certainly the side of the midterms in 2018. Let's look now at another country whose president is not known for his philosophical response to criticism. This is Turkey, whose outposts in Germany have reportedly asked local Turkish expats to report any criticisms which might be made of Turkey or its government, even suggesting that students could film any teachers who might embark on such critique. Chris, this story sounds mad, but it has been reported in quite plausible outlets. Does it sound like the sort of thing that the Turkish government would be instructing, or does it sound perhaps like a couple of diplomats in Germany have got perhaps somewhat carried away?
I would say it's pretty plausible from what I can read about it. I mean, one of the things you have to remember is that just earlier this month, we had the case of a Turkish religious body basically instructing people in Germany to keep an eye on people believed to be followers of Fethullah Gulen, the guy that that Turkey claims organized the coup last year. So it's all the idea of spying on people overseas. I mean, this is not something completely new at all. I mean, I think when you read some of the sources as well, if you read some of the people in the German education system who said this, I mean, it all sounds pretty credible. I mean, some degree of it is hearsay. It's all a little bit hush-hush. But I can certainly see it's plausible, Andrew. Yeah.
Just to follow that up, Chris. My mind is boggling. I suspect audibly, listeners, if that weird whirring sound, listeners may be able to perceive. Let's suppose this is true, and let's suppose people do take this suggestion up, and let's suppose they actually capture on film in a German classroom a schoolteacher saying something disobliging about the government of Turkey, though quite why a German schoolteacher would do that in what circumstances, again, is beyond me. But just for fun, let's suppose that this footage is captured. What on earth are they going to do with it?
Just to come back 1 second, the only other possibility that it might not be credible, of course, we have to remember, is that there are people in Germany who do not follow Angela Merkel's deals with the Erdogan government. That is what I would say. And therefore, creating the idea that they are somehow spying inside Germany would have a lot of political impact on the upcoming campaign for Merkel's re-election. But coming to your question, Andrew, you've got to remember that right now there are court cases are about to begin for all those people who've been detained in Turkey since the coup happened. So tens of thousands of people have either lost their jobs or been arrested or detained. We've seen some of the military officers starting to be tried this week. And by the laws of the fact that they have to eventually push people through this judicial system, people are also going to start to be charged. So the one thing that the Turkish government doesn't seem to have, because bear in mind that its extradition requests to the US have so far been largely fruitless, they don't have evidence of this double state that they believe exists in their country. So the idea of getting people to spy on Turkish kids, German-Turkish kids or Turkish parents who live in Germany and so on, if this is plausible, if this is true, I would say it's probably to try and create a body of evidence that they can take to the courts when they start to try those people who've been detained since the coup.
Is there perhaps an obvious explanation is occurring to me as of why they have been unable to secure any evidence that this parallel alternative state exists?
You mean why is there no evidence? You know?
I've got a fairly good idea of why there's no evidence. It's a bit like the sort of the lack of evidence for life on the moon.
I mean, one cannot deny, first of all, that Fethullah Gulen is extremely was extremely popular in Turkey. He did have followers. His movement was an extremely powerful, wealthy movement, and there's no denying that. And these people were part of the judicial system. They were part of the civil service. They were infiltrated into the country, but they were people with ideas, with beliefs of this guy's, Fethullah Gulen's ideas. But the idea of a parallel state trying to bring Erdogan down, where is the evidence? How do you start to create that kind of basis when you bring things to some sort of real judicial court?
Tom, Chris points out there the fact that, and it is, it's one of the many, many stories around the world which has been consumed by the giant orange supernova that is Donald Trump. Mm. But the fact that the coup d'etat of last summer is a story that has nowhere near run its course. There are, as Chris points out, tens of thousands of people out of work facing serious criminal charges. Between that And this kind of story, it is the kind of thing that gains traction and the kind of thing that creates an impression. How worried should Turkey be that it is beginning to create the impression to the rest of the world with whom it trades, with whom it has political and diplomatic partnerships, that it is getting, to put it tactfully, a bit weird?
Well, there's a twin track here. There's how worried it should be, and there's how worried it's going to be. I think there's another alternative. We come right back to your question about the purpose or the feasibility of these stories. It's feasible to me that, maybe not Erdogan himself, but some Turkey-based mischief makers would, legitimately propose this course of action, cognizant that actually there would be no evidence gained and there would be no purpose to said evidence, but that it would tweak the nose of Germany. You know, I think it's worth reminding the context of German-Turkish relations, which, if not at the lowest ebb, are strained. And I don't think, Erdogan, we've seen it with his conduct as regards Syria or with the Russians or with the EU more broadly, he's unafraid of tweaking the nose. He's unafraid of, a bit of strong-arming, just demonstrating his confidence. It's not dissimilar to the way that Putin seeks to manipulate the media, even if he's not interested in substantive gain. So, to me, it's plausible that this is more of a ruse, and it's to maybe, yank the chain, to cause some instability politically in Germany. It certainly is going to irritate enough people in Germany that maybe Erdogan and his friends would think it was worth it.
Final thought on this one from you, Chris. We have, in the last couple of years, seen some already epically stupid diplomatic wrangles between Turkey and Germany, perhaps most notably the discussion over whether to prosecute a German comedian for making a couple of jokes at the expense of President Erdogan. Prosecutors, or authorities rather, in North Rhine-Westphalia have asked state prosecutors to take a look into this to see if there is anything to it. How potentially ridiculous could this get?
Do you know, Andrew, how many times I've been asked that question in the last 18 months?
I mean, many of them by me, I'm aware.
one or twice by you. I mean, we've got to remember, before Christmas, there was the case of the German school in Turkey that Christmas was banned in, for example. There's been the vote in the Bundestag about whether to recognise the massacre of Armenians as a genocide. There's been case after case of these strained relations. And I want to pick on what Tom said is right. It's about tweaking the nose. And I think the thing you've got to understand with Erdogan, and this is, it takes a long time almost when you follow what he does, he's so focused on Turkey. He's so focused on the opinion of his heartland support. And every time he tweaks those noses and gets that bit of press, gets like, maybe Merkel can make a comment, maybe every single time that adds a bit of fuel to his fire, where he can turn around to the electorate and say, it's me against
the
world.
Well, look at his approval ratings.
Absolutely.
They remain very, very robust. And frankly, it's only his own public. Again, it's like Putin. That is the only stat that he's interested in.
Exactly. And they spike whenever these little spats happen, because he can turn around and say, it's me against the world. And look, once again, I'm defending Turkey's interests. This is our way of life. And that's why he does these things, I do believe.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Chris Lord and Tom Edwards. Coming up next, a look ahead to tonight's live event at Midori House, the venue, that is, not the programme, and a consideration of the political context of this year's Oscars.
Back in February 2007, 10 long years ago, the very first edition of Monocle magazine hit newsstands. A lot has happened in the decades since. From that first office in London's Boston Place to 7 fully staffed bureaux around the world. From the humble beginnings of Issue 1 to a media brand and business producing beautiful books, magazines and 24/7 radio and podcasts, to a chain of Monocle shops selling original ranges and collaborations with our favourite brands, to Monocle films, events and sellout annual conferences. Yes, a lot has happened and the next chapters aren't written yet. Happy birthday, Monocle, and here's to the next 10 years.
Okay. And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Mullett. Now, is London's food scene broken? That question will be asked at tonight's special live edition of The Menu, which starts cooking very shortly right here at Midori House. And I am joined now by the evening's host, Marcus Hippie. Marcus.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Welcome. The thing is now I'm confused about, because we're having to talk about two different Midori Houses. There is Midori House, the programme, which we are now on, talking about an event shortly to happen at Midori House.
I know, that's really confusing. That's what I sometimes struggle with as well, that sometimes I try to make a difference between Midori House and Midori House Studio One specifically, which is for broadcasting reasons.
I should have thought of that. But this is quite exciting. This is a live edition of The Menu.
Do you see how excited I am? I'm starting this program in about 40 minutes. There is a great lineup of guests, first of all. Unfortunately, anyone who is getting excited about coming to Midori House now, it's too late. We sold out. You should have listened to Monocle 24 more carefully, to be honest, because we gave you quite a few warnings. But anyway, we have Grace Dent joining us, who has been writing about restaurants to newspapers and magazines for 20 years. She's a very well-known columnist, and she's got a word to say about London's restaurant scene. Jonathan Downey then has been launching restaurants and bars the world over, and he's been focusing on street food in recent years. He's been organising street food markets with London Union around the British capital. Martin Morales is a pioneer of Peruvian food and also a former Apple executive in Europe. And a DJ, and
that is quite a CV.
He's going to DJ for us later on. He's got Peruvian restaurants all over London. And Nicholas Landry is joining us as well. He's the restaurant correspondent for the Financial Times. Can you think of a better lineup for a program like this, Andrew?
Next time
you can be a guest.
Off the top of my head, I cannot. But I wanted to bring you back to the core question it is addressing, which is London's food scene broken. What prompts that question? Because I think generally London has a good reputation as a culinary hub.
It does. It does have so much better reputation for food than for quite some time. It's doing amazingly well, in a way. But then again, there are many people who complain that this city is simply too expensive. You need so much money to launch a business, launch a restaurant, bricks and mortar location. And basically, some people may argue that we lose some spontaneous ideas because everything has to be so thoroughly calculated. So sometimes you could argue that maybe London's dining scene is a bit boring because everyone is playing so safe. You go elsewhere and you find more adventurous concepts. Then there's another thing which is going to get worse. Hospitality staff, how to find good staff over here. It's not going to get any better thanks to Brexit, when we have loads of Europeans who actually don't want to come here anymore because they don't see any future in this country. And also, more widely, considering how expensive everything is, if you have £1 million, if you had £1 million, Andrew, would you invest it in a restaurant, or would you think of something else?
Probably not a restaurant, no, but that's mostly because I know literally nothing about the restaurant business.
And actually, you don't make that much money with restaurants. And then some people think that the solution is that when you have one restaurant that is running relatively well, you want to make more money because you barely get a living with one, and then you turn it into a chain, and then you dilute the brand, and then that's boring again.
So basically tonight is going to be all about trying to figure out how you can still open and profit from exciting restaurants in a city where everything is so expensive.
Exactly, and also we have to think about how to make the city more exciting so we can enjoy it more. I'm kind of hoping I've got this secret agenda over here that I get great lessons and tricks and tips, and then I can finally open my Finnish restaurant somewhere close to Midori House.
That's coming up at 9 p.m. London time tonight.
1900.
You're right, 1900,
9 p.m. I'm already having my gin and tonics at the after party.
It has been a very long week. 1900 London time, live on Monocle 24. That's just for the purposes of confusion. That is purposes of avoiding confusion. Very long week. 37 minutes from right now, that starts The Menu, live with Marcus Hippie. Marcus, thank you for joining us. And finally, tonight.
I've been here a long time. And I'm from Cuba. A lot of black folks in Cuba. You wouldn't know that from being here, though. I was a wild little shorty, man. Just like you. Run around with no shoes on. The moon was out. This one time, I run by this old lady. I was running, hollering, cutting a fool, boy. this old lady, she stopped me. She said, running around, catching a boy that light. In moonlight, black boys look blue. You blue.
That is from Moonlight, which, according to bookmakers, will win the Best Picture Oscar on Sunday if La La Land doesn't. Though the bookmakers do seem pretty convinced that La La Land will. To discuss this and other aspects of the imminent Academy Awards, I'm joined by Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Ben, first of all, La La Land is going to win, right?
Probably, but let's not forget that we've been sure about Oscar winners before, and things have been massively, well, that's what they call an upset, isn't it?
We were also pretty sure Donald Trump wasn't going to win the election and that Brexit going to happen.
Let's not even go into that. But, I mean, look, so far in the awards season, it's been impossible to avoid politics. So interesting you should bring that up. I'm fairly certain that politics will come into this somehow as well.
I mean, on those two films, Moonlight and La La Land, Fernando, are there political subtexts in the films themselves, which obviously would have been made at a time when people assumed that by now we would have forgotten Donald Trump had ever existed?
Well, of course, you know, Moonlight is more political, you know, tone to it in a way, but in mainly because, you know, all the actors and the director, they're black, and yes, you know, in the last 2 years, you know, there was no acting nominees who were actually black indeed. So in that sense, but you know, I think Ben will agree with me that I hope Moonlight's not going to become like the black gay film, because actually it is a fantastic film that I think a lot of people will watch, no matter if you're white. You know, it's about empathy, you know, it's about love as well. And but I do think La La Land will probably get Best Picture, but I think I have a tiny hint that maybe for Best Director be Barry Jenkins with Moonlight. And I have to say, you know, everybody's saying La La Land is kind of escapism from reality, but I mean, I think those people maybe didn't see the film until the end, actually. I thought it was quite cynical, and I missed the glam there. I missed love.
Well, I mean, the political subtext is actually impossible to avoid in both of these movies. You've got one movie that a lot of people will view, Moonlight, as a response to the controversy that erupted at last year's Oscars, where there weren't enough black people, black Americans represented at the... Well, there just wasn't enough diversity at the Academy Awards. That's not why this film has become so successful, though. This film is successful because it's just damn so incredibly good. So La La Land, on the other hand, is also a political response because it's optimistic, it's fresh, it's something completely different to what we've seen in quite a while. But it's also about what could happen if we could just go back and change some of the mistakes that we'd committed. Just maybe take a different path. You know, it's assessing those regrets. And I think, Fernando, you are right. It is a little bit cynical, but it presents that message in quite a fresh and fun way. It's glorious escapism.
It's a tempting thought right about now, the possibility of altering the past in our favour. Fernando, are we expecting that there will be statements made from the stage by recipients of statues?
I would be surprised if they do not mention the name of Donald Trump, for example, when they get a prize. You know, I think it would be quite interesting because I think 95% of people who are attending in the Oscars, they're potentially liberal and anti-Trump in a way. Well, I'm not sure about Mel Gibson's view, but I think his film Hacksaw Ridge has no chance to win. So
hope not.
We're safe from that part.
Because the thing is that it is impossible to imagine that Donald Trump won't be watching, isn't it? He will absolutely be watching.
With I don't
sort
know
of
if
like
you've ever watched
thumbs
a full...
paused over his iPhone.
Andrew, I don't know if you've ever watched a full Academy Awards ceremony, but they go for quite a while.
He doesn't
I don't
seem
think
to be
could,
doing a lot else with his days.
That's true, but I mean, unless he's got the remote and he's flicking through, I'm just not sure he could sit down for a full ceremony. I mean, let's face it, 95% of the ceremony will be... It might have some sort of allusion to his presence, but they certainly won't be talking about him. I mean, this is the moment of Damien Chazelle, the writer-director of La La Land, and this is the moment of Barry Jenkins and Terrell McCraney, the writer of Moonlight. So this is the moment for a lot of people who have succeeded in their own right and have done so on their own merits, which, of course, you know, Donald Trump is not one of those people.
We will doubtless be discussing the fallout from this next week after the prizes have been distributed. For now, Ben,
Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining me at Midori House. Thanks also to our earlier guests, Tom Edwards, Christopher Lord and Marcus Hippie. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Ben Ryland. Fernando was our researcher, along with Helena Jarit, and our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. Do stay tuned for that special live edition of The Menu, happening about 30 minutes from now at 1900 London time. The cinema show will also have more on the film Moonlight. That's from 2000 London time, and you can, of course, catch up with those and everything else on our website whenever you like. The Monocle Daily is live from 2200 later on tonight. I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.